First of all, would someone tell me the time, please?
25 to 11.
25 to 11. Now, will you get up and tell the rest of us exactly what you mean by saying it's 25 minutes of 11? Is it not true that you haven't given me the time? Really, what you've told me is something by which you regularize your schedule, conduct your appointments. You've given me a quantitative measurement, but you really haven't told me the time, either in the biblical sense or the theological sense, because you did not correlate it with what is going on, what is happening, what the score is, what the action is, what I'm saying, and how this action is to be interpreted and related. This is the question that we must face at the beginning if we're going to talk about the function and the form of the church. What is going on in this world with which we have intercourse? What is happening? What is the action? How is this action to be interpreted? And what is the basis for the interpretation? If you will allow me to paraphrase a few words of our Lord, and I want to paraphrase them in the kind of language that we talk today so that you can really see the point. Our Lord once said to his disciples when they continued to misunderstand what his mission was, what he was about, "You guys are very, very smart. Indeed, you are so clever to be almost brilliant. You can look at the sky, and you can tell by its shape, by the shape of the clouds, by the color, sky, what the weather is going to be on tomorrow. But you cannot tell me what time it is." I think these words are very appropriate for us to begin our series on the function and the form of the church. Do we really know what time it is? Because we must first of all know the time, know what is going on, in order to be able to interpret it. And how can we interpret it unless we are involved in it and reflecting on it from the standpoint biblical doctrine? Do we really know what time it is? I think in the first place that it is very apparent to all of us that this is a time, sociologically speaking, of a tremendous revolution which is going on all over the world. This revolution is a basic one. It is so basic that it is changing the very framework of existence and the very fabric of thought. People no longer think and feel the same way in response to the situation. Certainly, if we look at it in the biblical sense, that the earth is being torn to pieces, the earth is shaking, the very foundations of the earth are shaking at this particular time. A general morphological revolution is now in prospect and is now going on, in which the world itself has already changed and continues to change. The old orders are disappearing. Even the language is changing. And the landscape that we once knew is no longer familiar. Now, this basic revolution that I'm talking about is an all-pervading revolution. It goes deep into the guts of society. And therefore, I feel that we are at a watershed of history. Indeed, modern times have passed away. And really, this is a new era in which we do not yet know the landmark sociologically. The guideposts are not always clear. We are on the way, somewhere, not knowing where we are going, but believing that we can find the way while we are traveling. While we are on the way, in the sense that Bonhoeffer talked about so long. These are extraordinary times, not a time for business as usual. And in this particular era, what I want to do is to look at these revolutions, which constitute the sociological, the situational framework in which the church has to operate at this particular time. The urban revolution, the revolution in civil rights, the technological revolution, the new technological revolutions, revolution which you can aptly name the cybernetics revolution, the organizational revolution which accompanies it, the rationalization, the kind of bureaucracy which has come up in order to interpret it and to make the life that occurs in this revolution tolerable, the explosion in knowledge, the population revolution which goes on. And I want to indicate, first of all, that these revolutions are not just local, but that they are worldwide, and that the basic revolution is one, and that all of these examples that I have indicated are faces of the same revolution, faces to be seen, handles to be grasped, so that what is going on can be understood. That these revolutions, which I'm going to enumerate more fully in terms of what they are and how they appear to be, are differentiated in terms of their faces, that some of these faces are quiet, others are very dramatic, as we know, still others are staggering, like the civil rights revolution, some are dignified, others are ludicrous, some are threatening, many are challenging. But it is not enough to talk about the fact of revolution, about the situation as it is, which the function of the church has to be addressed to. But we have to locate in some very, very real way the nerve, the purpose of this multifaceted, this many-faced revolution. To find out what it is all about and what the decisive questions are. And it will be one of my theses that this revolution is raising at this time some of the most tremendous theological, moral, philosophical questions of our day. To wit, what does it mean? What does it cost to be human? What is the locale? Where is the place? What is the setting in which this struggle to be human takes place? How can a person in this day, in our time, participate in the benefits of society? Relate to his fellow man, not on the basis of how much money he has, or who his old man was, what his status is at the present time, what is the functional role which he plays in society and how this is to be measured and weighed, but how can a man participate on the basis of his personhood? His humanity, his essential humanity. How can he benefit in the benefit, how can he participate in the benefits of American society, realizing his rights, his responsibilities, and his duties on the basis of who he essentially is? Then another and a fourth major theological question which is being raised is, how do those, in the words of John Steinbeck, how do those who ain't got yet, how do those who have not have, and in what way can those who have not get what they have, especially when those who have do not want them to have and resist their having? This is one way in which the question is being raised, unconsciously theological, because the term man is being used in all of these. All of these faces which I have been talking about. The man question is being used and raised, and the God question, though, is in the background. So that we are going to analyze this series of revolutions and then begin to ascertain some other questions. Questions in terms of how is this revolution really related to its true subject, and who is its true subject? For example, in the Civil Rights Revolution, is the true subject the Negro who is oppressed in Mississippi, or is it the redneck who continues to oppress him? Is it the slum landlord who exists in Chicago on the West Side, or is it his tenant who is actually tired of these conditions and the situations in which he is placed, and now is breaking out all over? Who is the true subject? Or is the true subject God? Is God in the midst of all of these changes that are taking place? If so, what is God doing in this series of revolutions? Where is God doing what he is doing? How is God doing it? And how does this really determine the function of the church? Is it the function of the church then to take the lordship of Jesus Christ seriously in the world and to hurry, to run, literally, to gather where God is at work? If this be the case, what are the tools other than the biblical tools? What are the situational tools by which we read what he is doing in fomenting this disorder, this judgment, maybe this promise in the situations which we face today? How do we ascertain what it is that God is doing, and how reliable are the situational tools? What then is the purpose of the church in response to what he is doing? Is the church obligated to be as situationally and as sociologically sharp as it is biblically sharp? These are the questions that we are going to ask as we consider the revolutions that we are going to go through in some detail. And then we are going to ask a fundamental question that we all ask as pastors, as church people who are involved, and that is it enough in terms of making the response to God's dynamic activity in history? Is it enough simply to take the structures that we have and simply put band-aids on them, or to give the church a hypo in the arm, even if it perks the old gal up momentarily? Is this enough? Is this enough? Can we do with the structures which we have? Or do we have to do a more radical kind of surgery? Is the church then a worldly institution on the one hand, and a holy institution on the other, or is the church both a holy institution and a worldly institution in which there is what has been called the church world overlap, in which the dynamic manifestations of our society have really been made and influenced by the church, and on the other hand, the society itself has dynamically influenced what we call the church? What then is the definition of the church? Is the church world dichotomy and act one? And also, we are going to ask, pretty fundamentally, the question, is this a time in which this series of revolutions which I have been talking about, is this fundamentally the time that the turn of history is so decisive and so great that none of the measures that I've mentioned, neither reform or patching, nor renewal or drastic surgery, is enough? And we must begin to die to the things to which we already dead if we are going to have the proper functioning and forming or shaping of the church. Die to the things to which we already dead, so that something new may rise. And on what base is this to be ordered? Is it on the basis of situational sharpness to the world, or is it in terms of understanding and obedience to the gospel? In other words, it's a question of the mission of the church. Then we are going to begin to examine just what this response to the activity of God in the world is. What are the shapes, if we take seriously the fact that we are called together in the church where God is at work, what are some of the possible shapes? In other words, to suggest them for our critical evaluation, to look at them in terms of how adequate they are, how they conform, as it were, to what we understand the definition of the church to be from the standpoint of the New Testament, and ask fundamentally the question whether or not structures in themselves are ad hoc structures. That is, any structure is determined by the call of the Lord and the essential obedience of the church to that Lord in response. Then we are going on and talk about some of the new forms, very practically, certain forms that are concerned with dealing with personal crisis areas, such as programs concerned with alcohol and narcotics addiction, programs which meet the world at its point of strength, such as the evangelical academies in Germany and certain business industrial projects in these United States. We're going to talk about certain trans-parochial or extra-parochial structures where the area of public life, in the sense that has been mentioned by Gibson Winter, are being dealt with in areas of unemployment, for example, in areas of housing. We're going to talk about small groups which have developed around house churches or ministry to artists or ministry to musicians. And we're going to talk about those critical issues in which God has apparently raised up movements which have many of the marks of the church, such as the freedom movement, and to evaluate in what sense is this the church or an approximation of the church. And then we are going to take very seriously the whole matter of involvement, in reflection upon the involvement, and in what way can we look at this and what this does both to the concept of the church as gathered, the concept of the church as dispersed. For example, we're going to ask a question that is very threatening to many of us who are pastors. Is the congregational form, the form of the congregation, adequate to do the job in our day? That must be done if we put our whole ministry in the context of mission. What are all of these areas to which, from a congregational base, we cannot minister very relevantly? And in what way can we begin to move out into those areas of concern, those areas of opportunity in which we are called to minister? What are to be the marks of a church, let us say, set in a tavern community or dealing with an unemployment crisis? Is the modern form of the church, in terms of the tremendous amount of growing unemployment, for example, in these United States, is this a union or an organization of the unemployed? In what way can we call this into being as a part of our ministry without losing the life of the church according to its biblical marks? As I say, these are some of the questions that we hope to ask, and many of the problems that we expect to raise from the standpoint of a person who has been a practical parish minister, who has been involved in some of these things. And I cherish this as a real attempt to be open, to admit where we fail, to admit where we have not been able to set up hypotheses, because hypotheses did not seem valuable, to look at certain inferences that we have and to share in this conversation together so that we can develop what is most needed in our time. And that is a proper understanding of what the ministry is in this period of revolution. In other words, how do we deal with these crises in such a way that we understand that we must have a profound knowledge of our tradition, of our scripture, that we must have a profound knowledge of the social forces which animate our world today, that we must have an acute sensitivity to people, that we must be highly disciplined to face the facts as they are and not to run from these facts, and at the same time to understand that our role may be one of essential creativity, that is, innovation on the facts, and yet understanding that we are participating as the people of God in response to his call in the new man who is Jesus Christ. And for what purposes? We said on yesterday that the context is essentially different from that of the past, that we are in a time of revolution, and that we can best understand these revolutionary times by looking at the particular faces that are to be seen and the particular handles that are to be grasped. I want to talk about some of these faces and handles. The first one I want to talk about is what we call the urban revolution. The urban revolution is a complex phenomenon. It constitutes the very atmosphere in which the church circulates and breathes. What it is an increasing variety, scope, and scale of explosive actions which are occurring simultaneously and portending serious but necessary dislocations in order to set the world aright. You'll find that the urban revolution of today is tied in with the so-called revolution in rising population, that one out of every 25 persons who have ever walked the earth is walking the earth today, that our population is growing in the world at a general rate of about 2% a year, and this, of course, is tied in with the growth and the proliferation of cities, because cities are growing at twice the general rate. And the amazing thing is that in big cities, the larger metropolitan areas, the population growth is occurring at twice the growth in cities. And what you have is an axiom that the bigger the city, the faster the population grows. The bigger a city, of course, the faster it grows. I think we all recognize that our cities are both growing up and they're growing out. Nearly one half of America, for example, you will find living in the 12 largest metropolitan areas. Consider the fact that 60% of America now live in something like 200 out of 3,000 counties. That 80% of America, pretty close to it, you will find living within commuting distance of cities of more than 25,000 population. Contrast this, of course, with what we already know, that our rural areas are depopulating, that our farms are growing bigger, and our farmhouses fewer. That 77% of the rural counties in the United States lost population from 1950 to 1960. That the small towns, as we know them, are becoming even smaller. And some are rapidly assuming the aspect of ghost towns. I was in Cripple Creek, Colorado last week. This, of course, is a famous city that once claimed a population of 40,000, and now it claims the astronomical figure of 400 in the winter and 1,000 in the summer. Our small cities are growing into metropolitan areas, and our major metropolitan areas are growing into vast concentrations of urban sprawl. Point is that everything is urban, and we define urban as any place wherever the factor of urbanization has become predominant. That the church is set in an urban context, irregardless of geography, wherever it is, This is a context in which we have to minister. Also in America, we have another phenomenon, and that is the coming of Megalopolis. For example, if you go from Portland, Maine, and you start south from this particular city, you pass through one continuous strip until you get down to Norfolk, Virginia. You will also find that another megalopolis will sweep the southern side of the Great Lakes. For example, you will find that northern Indiana is tied into southern Wisconsin by a knot, which is called the Loop, which is called Chicago. And you will find still another megalopolis on the massive coastline of California. In other words, everywhere urbanization makes itself felt. The population of today's metropolitan area population is larger than that of the whole country in 1930. Just 30 years, and you have a population in our metropolitan areas larger than the entire United States just 30 years ago. Of the 190 million people in the United States, you might divide them something like this, that one-third live in the core cities, one-third live in the suburbs, part of the metropolitan area, while you may concede, and you'll have a hard time reaching this figure, that another third live in small towns and in rural areas. And the trends of growth, the way we project future population, these ways are very, very clear. Because we know that three-fourths of the future growth in the United States is going to take place in the suburban ring. It's very interesting how this is to be done. Because already we are getting certain patterns. We're getting a pattern, for example, where the Negro is about to take over the central city or the core city, and the white man, the suburbs. And part of the tension and part of the struggle is whether or not the Negro shall remain permanently in the core city, the white man remain in the suburbs, communicating across the wall from each other, or whether there will be an explosive burst of Negroes in terms of movement in these suburban areas. Truly, we can say that a nation of farmers has become a nation of city dwellers. And we can almost say that a world of farmers is about to become a world of urbanites. Dr. Sam Kinchlow, who is perhaps the dean of American church sociologists, said about 20 years ago something like this. He said, you know, that everything is changing in terms of the rapid burst of urbanization. We are living in extraordinary times. The church has to make extraordinary responses to these times. And things are changing so fast that I never know where I am. I cannot locate urbanization in terms of physical space. For example, it looks like all the Yankees are going south. All the southerners are coming north. All the cattle are coming east. All the cotton is going west. And everybody, yes, everybody, is going to town. Dr. Sam Kinchlow made this prediction, or made this statement, many years ago when he was at Chicago Theological Seminary and in the Federated Faculty of the University of Chicago. Today, he's had many careers. He's been a college president and is now a professor of sociology at the Interdenominational Theological Center in Atlanta. Certainly, his words are about to come true. The other thing that we can say about this urban revolution is to recognize the fact that the idea of the city has been extended. That the old idea of the city has been blown to bits. The gung-ho term is not now city, in terms of separating inner city and stable residential neighborhoods and suburban areas. The new term, the gung-ho term, is metropolis. And when we talk about urbanization from now on, understand that we mean that it is difficult to separate rural from urban, that the old dichotomies no longer make sense. It's not so easy anymore to talk and say that we're talking about the city, or we're talking about the suburbs, and we're talking about the rural areas. Actually, we are talking about the impact of urbanization upon the whole American culture. I hope we understand this, because to illustrate this, I was in the state of Oregon not so long ago, and I was in that part where the farmers are perhaps the richest in the United States, who have the huge crops and they make so much money. And I was in this place where there was a farmer who had two sons, and they were having a family argument. The family argument was about where they were going for recreation that evening. It seemed as if the wife and the mother wanted to go to San Francisco to enjoy the Repertory Theater. It seemed as if the old man wanted to go to Seattle, because he wanted to hear some good music. Now, the two sons, they were also divided. One wanted to go to Portland to visit friends. The other one wanted to go, I believe, to San Francisco in order to enjoy the nightlife of this night city. So what happened was that they compromised. The old man and his wife got into one airplane and flew where the wife wanted to go, to San Francisco, in order to enjoy the Repertory Theater. The two sons got into the other airplane, and of course, they went to Portland in order to visit some girls that they knew. This is a situation that is an exaggerated circumstance, but indicates that urbanism is portable, that regardless of where a person is, he has been affected by the factor of urbanization. And you can give example after example of the shift in shopping centers, the fact that many rural people go 100 or 175 miles in order to shop for something that they like. Men are no longer tied to physical space. We are no longer space-bound, and distance almost means nothing. In other words, organizational space is more important than physical space. This is the thrust of urbanization. And the important thing is that the context in which we live and operate and in which we are called to minister is a context into which we are all tied by a network of relationships, structures of power and influence, which have their nodal point in cities. Now, this is a fact that is made very much of by Kevin Lynch, who is a professor at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and who wrote a book that all of you should read, which is entitled The Image of the City. Not only is this urban revolution, which I'm talking about, a revolution which is occurring in the United States, but it is also a worldwide phenomenon. It is global in terms of its influence. For example, in all countries, care where it is, people are being pushed off the land, being pushed from the farm, and they are being pulled into cities. Think about cities that have grown, that have had very rapid growth in population over the last decade. You can think right along with me. Turin and Milan in Italy, Lagos, San Juan, Johannesburg, Nairobi, Dakar, Calcutta, Delhi, Bombay. These are cities that are very important for us to understand and to know something about. In other words, the metropolitan society is beginning to take shape all over the world. And as it takes shape all over the world, it does not necessarily go through the same stages as cities have gone through in these new United States. I'd like to quote Gibson Winter in his The New Creation as Metropolis at this point, in which he says something like this: a new society is taking shape before our eyes. This is a society full of promise. Metropolis is the form of the new society. It is the possibility of a unified human society arising from the chaos of our massive urbanized areas. Metropolis is the face of the new society. Metropolis is a mother city, the nurturing totality of interdependent regions and municipalities, where children may find a climate conducive to growth, where education may enrich life as well as capacities, where men and women may have opportunity to participate as members and receive their rewards, and where advantages may be distributed with equity. Metropolis is the realization of unity of life out of the conflicting factions which now plague metropolitan areas, the fulfillment of the oneness of mankind out of the division of races and classes that now disrupts the metropolitan areas of our country. Metropolis is the human society which different groups avert and which all groups need for their well-being. Metropolis is the power of the new mankind refracted through human history. Metropolis is the local expression of the worldwide search for humanity and life. Speak of Metropolis is to look with hope upon metropolitan conflict, a phenomenon that is going on all over the world. The expectation is, the projection is, that 95% of the population of this world will live in cities soon after we turn into the 21st century. The reasons are obvious. To get places quickly, in order to move goods quickly at minimum cost, to concentrate markets of labor, to have specialization, delineation of role and function, to achieve quick and easy communication among men. Now, I think that we ought to take this context seriously, that not only are we urban in the United States, but we're almost urban in the world, and very, very soon our whole mission will be set in a context where 95% of the world's population is going to be living in a new and changed state. And this trend is continuing. Despite all of the disadvantages, all of the disorders, all of the problems that we associate with cities. In fact, we can say that cities are like women. They are hard to live with, and you just can't do without them. You can't live with them, and you can't live without them. They are exasperating. You might say that there are many cities that are very dirty, and there are many cities in terms of the difficulties and problems that they have, that you might say that their slips are showing. These slips are dirty. And one thing you know, that if they aren't dirty, like Paris, that at least the slips are tattletale gray. And yet people prefer to live in them. Why? Because ever since the turn of this century, the city has been looked upon as a haven, as a sanctuary, as a gateway to human dignity, freedom, to equality, to expression. And there is a saying, of course, in Harlem, for example, the Negro ghetto, as bad as it is, the saying to the effect, quote, I'd rather be a lamppost on Lenox Avenue than to be the mayor of Podunk, Georgia. You can illustrate the disorder, you can illustrate the problems, you can multiply them, not only in terms of the United States, but also in terms of the other cities of the world. For example, did you ever try to find a street address in Tokyo, as I did not so long ago? Did you ever look at the misery of, I don't know the number, the figures vary, of, let us say, 650,000 people in Calcutta, India, who do not have a place to sleep at night? They have no roof over their heads. What they do is to perform all of the functions that a family ordinarily performs in the streets. They eat in the streets. They sleep in the streets. They make their toilet in the streets. And at night, when you walk on some of the streets of Calcutta, you are stepping over people who are lying there
You really don't know if they are alive or dead. Those who are fortunate enough to have a roof over their heads, of this number, about 60,000 sleep in the two railroad stations, one at Selda, the other at Howrah. And each one of them is about half the size of Grand Central Station in New York City. I don't know how this would compare with the railroad station in St. Louis. And those, there are others who are fortunate enough to have apartments, to have homes. 98% of this number is, it is estimated by Paul Ilvesacker, who headed up a special planning program for the Ford Foundation. And he tells us, or he estimates, that 98% of those having shelter are required, obligated, to share their homes with friends, with relatives, and even strangers. That literally, a person cannot roll out of his bed without touching somebody else. All this in a city which has a per capita income of less than $100 a year. And yet, in spite of all of these disadvantages, all of these limitations, Calcutta grew over the last 12 years from a population of 3.5 million to 6.25 million people. It was my opportunity about 2 years ago to visit another city in India that had not been there when I was there before. In fact, this city grew within the last 8 years. It was an open field. But it so happened that the Soviet Union put in a huge steel mill. The steel mill is one of the leading producers of the Indian government. And on this open field, where 8 years ago there was nothing, there is now a population that pretty soon will be 500,000. In other words, the rate of growth of the cities of the world are indeed staggering. And we have at least 60 cities in the various countries outside of the United States that already have populations of more than 1 million. Bombay, India, for example, it is projected, has the possibility of growing to a population size of 35 million if it follows the Japanese style of the growth of cities. So understand that the context of our mission from this time on is set in an urbanized world. More and more cities growing up, increasing in population, and then growing out in terms of suburbia. And regardless of the of how much food is being grown, regardless of the status, small towns and rural areas, their future is not very promising, because we are going soon to be living in a world that will be at least 95% urban. Now, you cannot talk about the urban revolution without talking about its sidekick. And its sidekick is the technological revolution. And when I say the technological revolution, I'm simply talking about the second industrial revolution. If you would define the first industrial revolution as one which had steam for its prime power, and what it did was to introduce machinery that replaced the work that we once used to do with our hands, you can then define the second industrial revolution, the revolution in technology, as one in which the prime power is electricity. And it now is introducing machinery that replaces the work that we used to do with our minds. I'm talking about the cybernetic revolution. I'm talking about the computer revolution. I'm talking about all of these things in which we are seeing a new kind of machinery, a new kind of labor-saving device, which in turn is having effect upon all of the organizations and structures of which we are part. And the technological revolution really is changing the whole landscape of America. For example, I think we all recognize, we all know, that the assembly line in the old sense is disappearing, or it has disappeared. There have been no gains in manufacturing and blue-collar work over the last decade, In fact, the gains in employment over the last decade were not in the field of labor at all, whether you're talking about skilled labor or unskilled labor. The gains were in such fields as scientific, professional, and highly technical areas. For example, there is now a plant in New Jersey that employs only 9 men a shift, and it works on a 3-shift day. 27 men, and this plant already is producing 75% of the nylon now produced in the United States. 27 men, highly automated kind of thing. 9 men per shift. Is this the kind of production? Is this the kind of work that sets our sights for the future? Think of the fact that already many of our industries, many of our unions are thinking in terms of a 20-hour week. This means that in terms of the normal routines of work, sleep, that every man is going to have at least 100 hours a week for free time. What are we going to do with this? The revolution in technology means a new look at the meaning of work. What is work and what is leisure? Because most of our work will not be done in the old sense. It will not be productive work on a line, on an assembly line, in terms of seeking support for the family. What does this do? Already, prototypes of what has happened are already in evidence. For example, I know an area in Chicago where at least 23% of the workers who were gainfully employed as late as 1958 have not worked since that year, and now they believe that they will never work again. I know an area in Chicago where every other youngster between the ages of 16 and 21 is both out of school and out of work. That in terms of the technological revolution, what is occurring is that there is a new group of people, estimated at 1/4 of America, which is unable to enjoy and to utilize the benefits of this great technological revolution of which we are a part. They are underutilized, they are underemployed, they are unemployed, they are underloved. Perhaps they are prototypes in terms of trying to find out what work is to be or how income is to be received apart from the productive efforts of America. Especially when you realize that some economists are mad enough, crazy enough, to project the fact that by the year 2000, we will only need 5% of the working force to do all of the producing for the other 95%. What is this going to do to the concept of work, this new technological revolution, which is setting the context in which we have to live and minister and work? Another sidekick to the technological revolution and urban revolution is what we call the organizational phase, or the organizational revolution. And it is concerned with how do we get the ill-structured problems of mankind so systematized, so formalized, that we can make them into well-structured problems. Already, I suppose, you have lived in cities where some 20 or 30 years ago, the local employing concern was one that was at home. You knew the president because he lived in the house on the hill. He was a real citizen of that community. He was in face-to-face relationship with his employees. But over the last 30 years, we've had merger after merger, combine after combine, until today, almost every company in America has undergone diversification, combination, mergers, to the effect that No one really knows where the source of power is in the firm for whom your layman work. He's usually some vague, generalized person who lives way off somewhere in some capital or finance or industry. And this vague entity is supposed to tell your layman, the layman in your parishes, where they can live, how long they can stay, even whom they can marry, and they exercise a tremendous amount of control over the people that are in your churches in terms of where they stand on the success escalator, in terms of how much vocational advancement they shall have and when they shall get it. So that many of our people in America are affected and are organized in terms of catching the essence of this organizational revolution. Not only has there been this kind of revolution, but there has been a revolution in thought. For example, we know four times as much as we knew in 1940. In fact, the quantity of available knowledge doubles every 10 years. For example, there are 2 million scientific reports that get published annually. Who can read them? At the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, the librarian receives 75,000 scientific journals a year. It is estimated that if these publications alone grow at their present rate, that by the year 2100, their weight will exceed the weight of the earth. A tremendous revolution in knowledge, or at least in the quantity of useless knowledge. Because I have been associated with engineering schools part of my career, I am very much convinced that ideas and concepts that we once held are being challenged. I believe that there are mechanistic models of man on the make. I was talking with Houston Smith of MIT about this about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and he was explaining to a seminar on continuing education that there is a very good possibility that life is going to be created. And we are going to explain how it works. Already the possibility of creating minds is here. Depends upon how you view the computer. That we already have within our hands the means of creating adjusted personalities by means of drugs. And certainly, we have done much more experimentation than the ordinary person realizes in terms of creating the good society by conditioning. A revolution in thought, which is the context in which we have to minister from this day on. But I think that the most important of these revolutions and the most challenging to the church right now, and one that the church cannot evade in terms of its ministry and its mission, is the crisis in black and white, as it's called in a recent book by David Silberman. That is, of course, the Negro Revolt. The revolt against humiliation, the revolt against contempt of a segment of our society which has long been held in contempt and which has long been humiliated. Last summer, which was 1963, was the real breakout of this revolt, the summer of the Negro's discontent, as it was called, in which the Negro enunciated, South and North, that he was willing to go for broke in terms of sacrifice and risk to push to get all of what was his just due now. And what he summed it up as, that he wanted acceptance as a human being, that he wanted acceptance as a man, that he wanted a job, that he wanted to live next door, regardless, that he wanted white people to face up to his essential humanity in terms of all of the taboos that they have, in terms of whether or not a Negro could kiss his sister on the lips and ask for a hand in marriage. In other words, the right to marry whomever he loved and loved him. Whether or not, if you say, well, I can't accept that, aren't you really relegating the Negro to a second-class status thing that all everything but this, and really saying that the Negro's humanity is subject to certain limitations. The Negro broke out of this circle and simply said that he had to have a job, that he had to have freedom from contempt, that he had to have the right to housing and not pay the double standard dollar, that is twice as much as anyone pays in order to live where he pleased, and that kind of thing. And so this revolt has had repercussions throughout the country, throughout the world. But it is interesting that this crisis in black and white, this revolution, which the church must face up to and is part of the context of our time, that this revolution is asking essentially of the church a theological question. And it might be put like this. Can any man, can any of us, walk on the sidewalk of privilege, opportunity, and dignity, as long as his brother is forced to walk in the gutter? It's not the proper place of those who are concerned with a brother, that of getting down into the gutter with a brother, being willing to bear his burdens, being willing to go for broke with him until such time as both can return to the sidewalk, get out of the gutter, walk on this sidewalk hand in hand and arm in arm with all of the color bars obliterated. As part of this picture, and in asking the theological question, the Negro has been asking of the church another kind of question. To what end are you committing yourselves? What are you committing? Are you committing your consecrated money in terms of saying that this has priority over the carpeting, over the new building, all of the other images that we have in terms of the extension of the church? Are we committing our dedicated people, our sanctified imagination, to put it into the middle of the Negro struggle in order to suffer what he suffers? Are we willing to forget our pretensions to glory and riches and honor until the Negro has reached his rightful estate? And are we prepared to follow the way of the cross in terms of helping him to reach this rightful estate? These revolutions, of which I have given illustrations, signifying a new kind of world, a new kind of man, perhaps, is the context in which we are called to minister. This is the context that the church has to operate. It requires a new kind of thinking, a new kind of feeling, a new kind of sensing, a new kind of intuiting. And we don't do any of the last three well. We've conceptualized so long that we've lost our ability to feel. We've lost our ability to sense. We've lost our ability to intuit. So therefore, these are issues and questions that set the stage for us in subsequent lectures to determine what the form, the function of the church is to be. We have to ask ourselves, what is going to happen inside of us as this new world takes shape, and it is taking shape? Can we overcome our own twisted and soiled images of ourselves? Are we really, as Sartre says, nauseous men? Are we really, as Camus says, crazy men? Are we really, as Heidegger says, dreadful men? How do we learn our identity? How do we learn our functions? What is to be the structure in which we are to minister in this new context? Can we will the means as well as the ends? Are there any questions? Yes, sir.
You might want to discuss this further, but this business of attitude of our people over against work is kind of a thing about the revolution. Will we talk about this?
Yeah, we plan to talk about it very specifically in terms of trying to ascertain the meaning of work in this new age. And whether or not we are tied to a concept of work that is not Christian, but really tied to the way that America has emerged, and whether or not it isn't right that people who have been dislocated or displaced should not receive incomes if they cannot get a job now, some kind of subsidy. Or do we really have to find a new kind of work, a new kind of job, apart from, you know, the regular means and modes of production?
I was thinking more in terms of maybe the, I guess, theology of it.
Uh-huh.
Maybe being very subjective on it. It's hard to say for me to spend all week long on my day off.
Uh-huh.
And I'm sure that this is a problem with my lay people too, and
yeah.
My identity is pretty well tied up with the fact that I'm doing something. I'm on the treadmill. Now, if you take me off that treadmill for $100 a week,
mm-hmm.
my layman off here, we're going to have some real
Some real problems, because actually part of the problem is that we have identified ourselves with the roles that we perform, and the minister has done this as much as anybody. And part of the problem is in terms of essentially finding our, you know, humanity or humaneness apart from what we do. How this is to be done, I think, is a proper thing that we should discuss and analyze. Yes, sir.
Yes, I think there's an intermediate thing that we must first be concerned with before the fact that 95% of the people have no job.
Yeah.
I have 90% of my congregation working for General Motors. These people say, I've got to work Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
These people say, I've got to do this. So the service,
mm-hmm.
the form of our service, is already changed drastically. Now, this will come first. For the great layoff.
Yeah. Yeah, in other words, that what you're saying is that as we look into defining or analyzing what it is that we ought to be doing, that the context of what we ought to be doing is already laid by the dominant factors of society as men are organized around their work or around their jobs. And the question is, really, not Sunday service.